Tiana to me at this record on Juno Shunaka. Chokshu Militan Jaina Tasman Shri Guru Shri Chaitanya Manopistam Satitam Jain Kute. Shayam Rupa Kadam Vaikam Dati Shapanantika. Thank you very much for coming and taking part. Anusyanam Sahasrishi. Out of thousands of human beings, the Bhagavad Gita says, maybe one will be interested in spiritual perfection. Anusyanam, out of thousands. Mostly, our attention is turned toward some temporary benefit. There are two words in Sanskrit that are worth looking at. One is prayas, and the other is shreyas. Prayas means immediate benefit. And you do it, and there's a quick payoff. And shreyas means long-term benefit. So some people are really ultra-prayas in their orientation. It's like, whatever is going to make me feel good in the next 10 minutes. And some people are more long-term. They're thinking about their career. They're thinking about their future. They're maybe putting off the immediate gratification that they could have in favor of something more substantial that lasts longer. You're all students, so to some extent you're doing that because you could be out partying, but instead you're studying, you're undergoing some trouble because you have your future in mind. So that's called shreyas, or long-term thinking, long-term benefit. But generally, the long-term benefit that we think of is at most, the longest term we think of is this life. If you think that long. Usually it's a shorter block. Come on in. We saved a lot of seats for you. Usually we think of our lifetime. But the Bhagavad Gita gives us a different perspective and says that this lifetime is just boom. It's very short. Durlabha manava janma tadapi adhuvam artha. The meaning is that it's hard to get the human life. You know, we're here and we think, well, you know, here. But according to the Vedic knowledge, this is something we get after millions of lifetimes. There are so many different forms of life. The trees, the plants, the birds, the fish. And how many human beings are there out of all those different living beings? I count the number of ants on campus, and you know, the human beings would be a small number. So here we are, we have this human life. And artadam means that one, well, adhruvam means it doesn't last that long. It doesn't last that long. 100 years is a big deal these days. Quite often it's more like 70 or 60 or 50 or sometimes a lot less. Not very long, and it goes fast. But artadam means that in the human life we can get the greatest benefit. Artha can sometimes mean money. You know, it can mean wealth. But the real meaning of artha is real wealth, real benefit, real value. The real value is on the spiritual platform. Generally we think in terms of the material platform, which means a body. The body is a material thing. Comes and goes. And we identify with the body and we do things for the body. We want the body to be comfortable. We want senses to be pleased. And that can preoccupy us. That can occupy our whole life. generally, especially, we get married, we get a job, and we're working most of our time to get money to be happy. Working isn't very happy, and that's what we're doing most of the time. Then we get a little bit of time when we're not working, and we get to have some sort of happiness there, which lasts a little while and then it's back to work. And that's our life. But the Vedic literature says that's not our life. That's not the life for, that's not the purpose of human life. That's not the gain in human life. That doesn't take advantage of the opportunities of human life. Pramajigyasa, the human life gives the opportunity for spiritual realization. And that's the business. Jivasya tattva jigyasa, narto yas cheya karma vidhi. The idea is that what we need to keep going, that much we should see to. You know, we don't want to starve. We don't want to be starving in other ways that we have no comfort, no happiness, no, you know, just living like gritting our teeth and somehow living another day. That's not the idea. We should have what we need, but that's not the purpose. That, well, now I have this big a house, I could have that big a house. Now it's that big, it could be twice as big. Or somehow make my life more comfortable. There's a story that there was a man who was working. In India they have canals, kind of shallow ones. And for small boats, the way they get the boat through is it's got a post, it's got a rope, and there's some guy on the shore who's pulling the rope and the boat comes through the canal. So there's some guy whose job that is, he's pulling the rope, and he's thinking, you know, I wish that I could have money, because then I would line the bank of the river with pillows, so that when I pull the boat, my feet will be comfortable. But that's not the idea, I have to figure some way to make our life a little more comfortable. The real idea is to understand who I am, to understand my spiritual identity, to understand that I'm an eternal living being, but I'm trapped in this temporary body. And after this body is finished, I'll be trapped in another material body and go through the same thing again. And that is not my... where's my long-term thinking? What am I going to do about that? The problem is not that the bank doesn't have pillows or that, you know, 100 other things. The problem is that I don't want to get old and I have to get old. I don't want to get disease and I have to get disease. I don't want to die and I have to die. And I really don't want to have to go through it again. I have to go through it again. Those are the problems of human life. Not the problem of political problem, social problem, economic problem, psychological problem. Those are the little ones. These are the big ones. Birth, death, disease, and old age. How to solve that problem is the real business of human life. The animals have no such opportunity. They can make themselves more comfortable. They can line their nest with a little something soft and cushy. They can get more food or better food. They can do all the stuff that human beings do in a more sophisticated way. But that's not the business of the human being. That I eat better, I sleep better, I have better sex, and I fight better. The animals are doing all of those things, and sometimes better than the human beings. They can fight better sometimes, they can eat more. You know, we're no match for, say, the hippopotamus. Right? In eating, the hippopotamus outdoes us, in sleeping, the bear, in sex, pigeons. So just to do the same stuff that they do, but, you know, put some neon around it is not the business of the human being. The real business is self-realization. The real business is to understand that I'm not the body, that I'm the soul in the body, that I have a relationship with the spiritual source from which I've come, and that I can have spiritual activity in that relationship that will be fully satisfying. The material happiness will not be satisfying and it won't last. It'll be mixed with trouble, and if I say, well, I'll take the good of the bad anyway, whatever I take, it'll be finished. So, Brahma-sokhyam pranantam. The Vedic literature points us toward happiness that is permanent, not because it's, you know, a picture of pie in the sky, but because it's based on who I really am, not on the shell of who I am, the covering of who I am. The mantra, the chanting Hare Krishna, brings us to that spiritual platform. It's the easiest way to have direct experience of our own spiritual identity. Therefore, it's the crucial method for spiritual advancement in this age. And I've said enough for a little introductory few remarks. And rather than just come on in my own direction, so I wonder what we might be thinking about or think to ask about. We'd like to talk about that. Wonder what sort of questions might be bubbling up there someplace and we need to come in. Yes. That's good. At the moment, you can say that we're a combination of matter and spirit, or of body and soul, because the two are together. And we can't, you know, just take a spoon or something, take one out from the other. So we're a combination. But which is more important?
The soul. But
soul, okay.
If you want to understand your soul, can you not understand yourself as a human form to understand yourself as a spirit?
Say it again.
If you want to understand yourself as a spirit, do we not necessarily have to understand our position within the soul?
Yeah, definitely. If we want to understand what we are as spirit, we need to understand the context. Right? Like he's got a bottle of water here. If I just think about the water and I don't think about the bottle, probably there's going to be a problem getting it from here to here. I have to think about both together. But still, I got to think that, you know, what I want to swallow is the thing that's inside, not the plastic on the outside. The thing that's important is the water, and the plastic is the container. A child might not understand that. You know, he'd chew on the bottle also. So the body is important in the sense that it's the container for the soul. But the soul is the more important thing. That's the essential thing. In the body, you know, somebody dies, and the body is stretched out right over here. It looks like a good place to put a cadaver. The body is stretched out right there, and nobody thinks, well, such a nice body, and how are we doing, and what are we, you know, because the essential part is gone. So we just think about, you know, where's a fire, or where's a pit to put this thing in. because it's useless now without the essential component. So we need to understand the body, but we have to eat, we have to sleep, we have to maintain the body, and that's the basic direction. We have to do some work, or the body's not going to be able to be sustained. That's necessary. But what's my purpose? You know, like I have a car. And some people, you know, they just get so car-oriented that the purpose is no longer to get from here to there. The purpose is the car itself. Right? It's all about the car. And where I'm going doesn't matter. So that's how it can be with the body. It's all about the vehicle. And where I'm going, well, you know, I don't know. So we want to reverse that priority and say where I'm going is what's important. And the body is important because I can use it to get myself there. So let's take a simple thing like your tongue. That's an important part of the body for all of us. So we need to eat. Now, in Bhakti Yoga we think, but let me eat in such a way that by eating my consciousness will also be purified. That by eating I'll make spiritual advancement. That by eating I'll come closer to Krishna. Otherwise I can just eat. You know. And the tongue says, yeah, that was great. But that's prayers. That's exactly what prayers is. I'm thinking, you know, what's good now? And it's whatever tastes good, whatever, you know. It may be the most terrible thing for my health even. It may be the worst thing for my karma. But it's there and I want it and, you know, that's it. But Shreya's long-term thinking, you think, that if I'm going to eat, let me eat in such a way that it becomes part of my spiritual life. So that then you accomplish both things. You maintain your body, you get health and strength and nourishment, but at the same time you maintain spiritual progress.
Do you do that that long-term conscious thinking with every material activity that you perform?
You have your material desires, but you just put them in connection with your long-term desires. If you want to be happy, but you don't think, well, because I'm going to be happy, I want to be happy, I'm just going to skip school and I'm going to do everything to make myself happy. You're thinking long-term. If I want to be happy, then I should do well in school and, you know, go on from there to whatever I want to do. So we have desires, but when you bring your desires to the higher platform, what is my ultimate desire? You can ask yourself that. Or ask anybody that. You want to do an interesting
street survey.
You know, what's your highest goal in life? And you get answers like, well, I think I want to be the most I can be. You know what I mean? You find answers that, you know, I want to get into politics so that I can lead the country and blah, 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 blah. Or I want to be a nurse, or I want to be a teacher, or I want to be a this. And that's, yeah, but what's your highest goal in life? And lots of times what you get is kind of emptiness. The question is, like, outside people's terms of reference. You know, highest goal in life. You know, they make grammatical sense out of it, but that's the only kind of sense that comes through. They don't know what it means. It's not something they've thought about beyond the context of, yeah, I think I'd like to be a biology teacher or whatever it is. So here we think about, okay, I desire to be happy. I desire to be, maybe I desire to be married. Maybe I desire to. So many things I desire. How do I connect my desires to my ultimate purpose in life?
What is truth?
What is truth? Wow. Well, a very large question. The Truth is ultimately what lasts. If it doesn't last, it's not true. That this body would be said to be untrue. Maybe like, you know, in ordinary romantic circles, you know, who's a boyfriend who's true or a girlfriend who's true? It's one who sticks with you. It lasts. So truth is what lasts, but what lasts permanently. So the body is not true in that sense. And the soul is true. And the supreme soul is true. And the relationship between the two is true. Everything else is not connected with that. It's not true. It's like a shadow of the truth. Okay? And what other questions might we have? What other questions?
Yeah.
I always thought that being spiritual, you know, recognizing your true self as a spirit and as a soul, I thought maybe shouldn't it be that you connect yourself with your body, because you, so then you illuminate your soul through your body in everything you do. So let's say you have a family one day, and that's your body, and then you just like give that. You give it to your family because it's who you are. You know, and then like if you have a child, sorry, if you have a child, and then you know you hold that child, and you could, I don't know, that this sounds very silly, you know, you should like feel it coming off you because you're just so full of it. Not full of it, but I mean full of your spirit. So, I don't know if that's like a wrong way of thinking or a completely silly way of thinking.
Let's see if I understand what you're saying. You've thought of spiritual life of connecting the soul with the body, and in let's see if I understand, giving spiritual meaning to the activities that the body, okay. Is that what you're having with? Yeah, that's valid. We have bodily activities. I mean, I wake up every morning, and then there's, you know, if you look at my day, the body has a whole day full of life to it. I work, I eat, I talk to people, I do so many things, which the body does. I mean, you could look at it and say, you know, body is doing all of these things. And unless it has a spiritual connection, we'd say it's untrue, we'd say it's meaningless. You know, if the body is only connected with other bodies, with physical objects, with physical things, with physical reality, and that's as far as it goes, then we say it's like living in a dream. The truth has been left out, the essential element that the body holds or that the body is for, is left out. So then, one way of saying you're living for nothing. You're living for nothing. It's just a walking dead body, really, like sleepwalking practically, or zombie life. And then when there's a spiritual understanding, now the body starts to have, bodily activities start to have meaning, because they're connected to truth. They're connected to the Supreme. So bhakti yoga, in that sense, is the art of connecting all of our bodily activities to Krishna, to the truth, to the Supreme. That's how one way of thinking about it. There's another way of thinking about it, which I don't know if it's entering your thoughts at all, but it's sort of out there in the ether, so I'm going to pull it out of the ether and bring it in. That's the sort of idea that spirituality needs to get more and more in touch with your body, to feel more what is happening with your body, to be right there with the experiences of the body, to really have to know what that is and enter into that more, you know, and by doing yoga, you know, you get more in touch with
your physical organism
and all of that. And people take that very seriously, and they think of that as being, becoming more spiritual. And that's just the opposite of what I'm talking about. Because that means my focus is going more and more to matter. You know, how do my back muscles feel? It's all about these, bit of biological rubber bands stuck together, and then that's what I'm putting my consciousness deeply into, whatever physical thing it happens to be at the moment. And that's not all of it. That means my focus is going from spirit to matter. It's again like the man who's really thinking about that car and shining it and revving it up and whatever else you might do to make that car more car than it is. That's what he's thinking about. He's not thinking about where he's going. So there's a kind of spirituality which aims that way. It's getting more into the car. And the result is forgetting more about the passing. But the way you expressed it, to connect, suppose if I have children, okay, then I'm thinking, how can these children be liberated from material existence? I have a responsibility. Is my responsibility to bring this child up to be, head of a Fortune 500 company or what have you? Or to get free from birth and death? To actually reach permanent self-fulfillment by self-understanding? So it's a good, very great thing to have a child. And how much responsibility is with me? And then, if the question of what is your highest goal in life is one that hasn't occurred to me yet, then what am I going to give to my child? So, but if on the other hand, I have a higher goal, if I have a goal, if my target is spiritual realization and getting free from material illusion and connecting myself with the Supreme, now I have something to give to that child. I have a life to give. So that kind of connecting of all of our, there's a physical reality there, there's a child, there's a husband, there's a home, but it all becomes connected. So that's back to yoga. Yoga means connection.
What's the difference between faith, belief, and reality? So let's just take, I'm not saying it's true, but let's just take as a possibility that there is no life after death, and there isn't a supreme power, and when you die, that's just it. Then faith and belief become meaningless. So how do we know the difference between reality, faith, and belief?
Take faith, belief, and reality. Let's put faith and belief in one bucket and reality in the other. Because, I have faith in something, I believe something, and it's not true. I believe that by buying this lottery ticket, there's every chance I'm going to become a millionaire. It's just not the way it is. Or I believe that this snake oil is going to cure me of cancer. And great, I have faith, I believe, I have absolute sincerity, and it's all rubbish. So reality is one thing, faith and belief another. I believe with all faith, 2 + 2 = 7. By faith, I believe the reality is something else.
Yeah, but how can we be certain that there's meaning in faith and belief?
Okay, so you have to look at your faith, you have to look at your belief and say, what's it coming from? I believe this is a wristwatch. But why do I believe it's a wristwatch? I believe that this person is my father. Why do I believe this person is my father? It's philosophy, that's epistemology, what's my source of knowledge. And there are different ways of getting knowledge. One is by direct experience. You know, I saw it with my own eyes. There's a problem with that, though, because my senses mislead me. I have a tendency to make mistakes, I fall into illusion, my senses weren't perfect. And what I thought was, what I thought was a soccer ball is an improvised explosive device. So my senses can mislead me. Then there's another way of getting knowledge, which is by induction. I think, I've seen this, and I've seen this, and I've seen this. I've seen 30 birds, and they were all black, so I can reasonably conclude that birds are black. By logic, I haven't seen the 31st bird, but because I've seen that the first 30 were black, I conclude by logic that the 31st one will also be black. And that flies by, of course, and it's purple. So there's a problem with induction also. We're working with our mind. The mind is imperfect also. And there are just places where the mind can't go. It goes, but it doesn't know where it's going. It doesn't know its way around. There are things that are simply unknowable by the speculative process or by logical induction. The classical example is that if you want to know who your father is, suppose you didn't know. By scientific research and trial and error, it's going to be an awfully difficult process to find out. And therefore we come to the third method, which is hearing from those who know. So the same project, you want to know who your father is, you ask your mother, and boom, you've got the answer in 1 second. Because you're coming from, you're getting information from a reliable source. I asked my father, what's this? And he says, it's a wristwatch. And the job is done. I don't know. I've never been to, say, Zanzibar. But you're coming from Zanzibar. I said, what goes on there? And you tell me, and now I know about Zanzibar. It's going to cost you $75 for a visa. Watch out for the pickpockets on the main front, and, you know, whatever it is. So, the best way, Bhagavad-gita says, to get knowledge, not just, you know, a kind of faith and a kind of belief, but substantial knowledge on spiritual topics, is to approach a person who's situated in knowledge. When we approach a person who's situated in knowledge, then we get knowledge from him because he's seen the truth. Shrotriyam Brahman is that. Who is that person? He is a person who's also received that knowledge that way, and he's experiencing that knowledge. Now, one symptom of that, you know, somebody can come here and say, well, you know, I'm a man of knowledge, and So, one sign of a person who's spiritually advanced is materially detached. See, a person is, you know, he's a great spiritual leader, but then you find out about his real life, and he can't give up smoking, he can't give up, you know, he's got a girl waiting for him in a hotel room, and, you know, so many things. He's completely stuck in matter. Then you can ask yourself, where is his spiritual knowledge? So the Bhagavad Gita lays out for us what the signs are of a person who's situated in knowledge. In the 13th chapter, there's a discussion. What is the process of knowledge? What are the signs of knowledge? Among it, from the first one is humility. And the person who's I know everything, because I'm, you know. My predecessors were all fools, but, you know, where they went wrong, I got it right. He's not the guy. It's a humble person who starts off saying, totally bewildered about what is what. And I have to approach somebody who knows, who can tell me the beginning of knowledge of this humanity. And it goes on from there, and they say,
but if we just take, let's just make it a fact that there is nothing after death. Let's just say that that's true. I'm not saying it is
okay,
true.
No.
But let's just say it's
true. Arguendo.
Yes, okay. So let's just pretend it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't you rather enjoy this life to its fullest and not live a minimalistic life?
Okay.
In the event that...
this life is everything, and rather than hope for pie in the sky when you die,
yes,
why not enjoy this life to the fullest?
Yes.
Here's one reason. Doesn't work. The more you try to enjoy, the way the equation works out is the more you suffer. You know, the person says, I've only got one life, let me go for it. He winds up with AIDS and, you know, you name it, he's got it. The more you try to increase your enjoyment, just make a beeline for it, the more you suffer. So that's the first thing. The strategy doesn't work. You know, given that, okay, I've got 50 years or 100 years or 10 years and I'm going to die, let me make the most of it. The direct beeline approach doesn't work. Instead, I wind up getting the opposite of what I thought I was going to get. That's the first thing. The second thing is that my enjoyment is more or less meaningless. That, okay, I've got 10 years or 50 years, let me enjoy as much as I can. But if I've got a brain in my head, I'll look at it and say, you know, what? What is the meaning of it? How is my enjoyment more significant? You know, we want significance in our life. That's a human, that's human life. Whether we articulate it or we just intuit it, we want it to mean something. And okay, I go out and have, you know, a great time in bed with some dream girl. And the monkey goes out and has the same thing. You know, so how is what I'm doing more significant than what the monkey is doing? And if it's not, you know, what kind of happiness am I getting? You know, I've made myself basically a super animal. I'm a human being aiming to get what the animals are getting as much as possible. So that's a second problem with it. And taking it another way, since it's meaningless, since there's nothing after death, since my life is just a batch of chemicals bubbling away in some sort of arbitrary pattern, what does it matter whether I live or die? There's a, you know, I walk across the street, I wait for the light to turn green, and then I walk. Why? Since this is it, it's just a batch of chemicals that bubble for a while. What's the difference whether they bubble for 100 years or 10 minutes more? Because my life is essentially meaningless. That's what, you know, if we're going to go there, that's where we're going to go. And there are people who go there and they say, that is the truth, that is the reality. But then, why write your book? And what's the difference between writing it and not writing it? Since life has no ultimate, you know, the difference between 100,000 people dying in a war and 100,000 people being happy and leading fulfilling lives is just the difference between 1100111 and 00111110. It's just a batch of, you know, it's just a different digital sequence. That's all it is. And it has no significance. So, you know, for that matter, hey, I want to enjoy. What's enjoyment? I would love to take an AK-47 and, you know, just kind of do a tour of Ritz and knock off with, you know, students. Why is that any more despicable than giving examinations for TV and giving people inoculations? You know, it's one. The first one was 00110001, and the second was 01110012. No twos. 1111. It's arbitrary. I'm just assigning that this is good and this is bad. But there's no good or bad, because it's just a bunch of chemical sequences, and nothing means anything, because there's no source of meaning. There's no reference point for meaning, except meaning is what I make of it. I say, we decide collectively that this is good, philanthropy is good, and shooting students is bad. But there's no objective reason for that. That's the kind of reality you're going to live in, that nothing means anything, nothing is good or bad, nothing is anything. It's just, and at the end you're going to be miserable, because that's the way it's set up. So even arguendo, assuming this is it, you just get this one life and then finish, even then, to chant Hare Krishna is a lot more satisfying. Spend a lot, it doesn't cost you anything. You can do it forever. You experience a kind of pleasure which does not run out, and which exceeds that, you know, 2 minutes pleasure. And if I was wrong in the idea that, well, this one life is everything, then I would come out way ahead. And if I was right, well, I didn't lose anything. Is that okay? Probably heard of Pascal's wager also. We're out of time.
It's 2 o'clock at the moment, so anyone who has a lecture or a test can shuffle out now. Just before you leave, there's one thing. Please don't forget our evening of kirtan that's taking place tomorrow. It's our second evening of kirtan for the year. Rhythmic mantra meditation and song and dance, so please join us for that great festival. Thank you for all that came out, and we have to leave now, and we'll see you tomorrow. Those who are staying, we can still raise and pose questions to Jai Vedic's phones. Thank you. Are there any further questions?
Questions? Who do I take first? Pearl? Okay.
You were talking about happiness, so I'm always confused the difference between human behavior and human nature. So when things like envy, jealousy, and all that other stuff, to consider human behavior or human nature? So what's human nature, basically?
Okay, good question. When we get envy and jealousy and all of this, is that human nature or human behavior? Well, it starts out as nature and then becomes behavior, right? First there's like the feeling, I'd like to do this, and then you actually do it. Say nature and behavior. But there's a deeper question, and that is, where do these different natures come from? Because there's different natures. Some, you know, I have an envious nature, or I have an altruistic nature. I have a benevolent nature, or an aggressive nature. Where do these natures come from? And that's answered in the Bhagavad Gita. There's a quite an extensive discussion about that, concerning what's called the three modes of nature. Have you talked about that at all in your meetings? Okay, no, I haven't talked about that. Really interesting topic. Three modes of nature, they're called gunas, or modes or qualities of nature. The three are goodness, passion, and ignorance. There are three different qualities. The quality of ignorance, the quality of passion, the quality of goodness. In goodness, there's knowledge, there's peacefulness, there's truthfulness, there's cleanliness, there's a kind of self-satisfaction, you know, whatever I got, that's fine, and I feel good about that. That's the mode of goodness. In the mode of passion, there's desires, longings, greed, insatiable thirst, and therefore there's intense endeavor. I gotta have it. I want it. I'm after it. Or after her, or after him, or whatever it is. You know, just desires upon desires upon desires, and therefore a lot of intense activity to get what I want. That's passion. And in ignorance, there's the dullness, there's inertia, there's madness, you know, just craziness, that's also in ignorance. The guy who thinks that he's Napoleon is deep in deep ignorance. There's intoxication, the guy who's, you know, these are all characteristics of ignorance. So these are three qualities of material nature. And by being in this material world, the soul has nothing to do with any of these three qualities. It's transcendental, it's beyond them. But by being in the material world, we become infected by these qualities. We pick up these qualities. Kind of the way the air picks up aromas. You know, it moves over the rose garden and it smells like roses, and it moves over the garbage dump and it smells like garbage. So the soul or consciousness in touch with material nature becomes associated with these qualities. And the three of them mix up like your three primary colors, red, blue, and yellow. They mix up and you get thousands of colors, different proportions. So sometimes, you know, I'm like 60% goodness, 20% passion, and 20% ignorance. Sometimes it's 80% ignorance, 10% goodness, and 10% passion. Any set of numbers that add up to 100, you can get that proportion. So people are not entirely good or entirely ignorant or entirely passionate. There's some mixture. And the mixture can, you know, vary from day to day, from hour to hour. So we're affected by these. It's not our nature. It's not my nature to be ignorant or passionate or even materially good. It's my nature to be transcendental. But I become infected by these qualities, and especially the real problem ones are ignorance and passion. And when I'm intoxicated, dull, mad, blind, then, you know, what can I do for my life except sink? And when I'm passionate, I'm confused. Ignorant, I get it backwards, you know, I think up is down and down is up. In passion, I'm not sure whether down is up or up is down. Sometimes I get it right, sometimes I get it wrong. When you're in passion, you know, you're not thinking clearly. You're not thinking clearly. People do things, you know, crimes of passion, right? People do things out of passion that if they thought about it, they would have said, no way. So passion leads to confusion. Sometimes in passion, you make the right move, and sometimes in passion, you make mistake of your life. But in goodness you get clarity. The mind becomes purified, the mind becomes clear, you develop knowledge, and from the mode of goodness, therefore, we make progress to the transcendental thing. So we want to come to the mode of goodness and be behind passion and ignorance. That's the idea, because they're all unnatural for us, but goodness is the jumping off place to transcendence. So the more we can put our life together in such a way that it's in the mode of goodness, and the Bhagavad Gita tells us what that is and how to do that, the more we make progress. There's food and passion, food and ignorance, like food that's stale, rotten, stinking, that's in the mode of ignorance. That's in the mode of ignorance. No, it's been sitting there for 20 years. It's got this beautiful blue mold in it. You can smell it from down the block. And they sell it for, you know, however many dollars per pound with a French name on it. But it's in ignorance. You know, it's basically somebody who knows what's what says, hey, that's rotten. So there's food in ignorance, or food that's been, you know, people eat things that are, well, I saw a fellow the other day who was like a really cool guy and he was pulling his food out of garbage cans. You know, so that's the kind of food that leads to disease, to the guy who's clearly in the mode of ignorance, a very unfortunate person. Then there's food and passion, which is like ultra hot, ultra salty, ultra sweet, ultra, 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 you know. And then your life goes like, first of all, it's like, is it healthy? No. You know, you wind up eating like, you can't eat just one, you gotta eat 72 of them, and you can't stop, and it has that great taste because it's monosodium something, something, something. And your mind starts to go that way too, you know, because the food is going, and your mind is also going, and so your life is going in that way. And then there's food which is simple, nutritious, tasty, pure. That's food in the mode of goodness. And you eat that food and your mind becomes tranquil, your body becomes healthy. And that's suitable for cultivating a life in knowledge. Or better, so you take that food, you offer it to Krishna, and now it's transcendental food. It helps you rise even above the motive of goodness. So, in eating, in working, in what you do, in everything, these three qualities are there: goodness, passion, and there's knowledge and goodness, knowledge and passion, knowledge and ignorance. There's determination in passion, determination in ignorance. Determination. So determination and goodness is you stick with something because it's your duty, because it's the right thing to do. Determination and passion is you do it because you're going to get something. And if you don't get it, then forget it. I'm determined to get it because I'm going to enjoy it. It may be right, it may be wrong, but I'm determined for my sense gratification. And determination and ignorance is, I can do it tomorrow. Maybe next week, actually. Actually, it doesn't matter very much anyway. Well, that's determination and ignorance. So when you read the Bhagavad Gita, you'll find out more about all of this and how to come to not just, you know, human behavior and human nature within the context of these three modes, but to our eternal nature. Okay?
Pearl, your question.
Okay. I just want to know, like, I understand that spirituality is important, but I feel like there's so many distractions that continuously distract you away from that. How do you maintain how do you eliminate the distractors so have to maintain the spiritual endeavor?
What a great question.
That's like a lifetime question. How do we keep our eye on the ball? How do we stay focused on our spiritual objective? And for that, there's practice. You know, how do I get geometry down? How do I become really good at buying and selling? How do I become whatever it is that I want to achieve? It's practice. how do I become a really good musician? It's, first of all, the right type of practice, because you can practice the wrong way and never get anywhere. So it's the right kind of practice, and then it's steady practice. What are the things that I can do that will keep me focused? What are the things that I can do that will keep me going in the direction I want to go in? If I have a higher purpose in life, if I have a spiritual objective in life, what are the things that will help me stay on that path to get there? And what are the things that are going to be, what are the distractions? What are the things that are going to pull me away and make it hard? So that's described, and that's what Bhakti Yoga teaches us. What are the things that we can do? Like this chanting of Hare Krishna. That's a very powerful thing that we can do. That helps us focus our minds on Krishna. Krishna means the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source of everything, ultimate spiritual reality. And the sound of Krishna is the same as Krishna. So by chanting this sound, I'm keeping my mind focused. And I can do that as a daily practice. I can do that as a daily practice, and then, you know, I'm on course. This eating this food, which is offered to Krishna, offering your food to Krishna and meditating, that's a very powerful spiritual practice. You can do that. It doesn't cost you more. It's only practice. That here's something I can do that's going to transform my consciousness from just how do I fill my belly up and make my tongue feel happy, to how do I accomplish those things as, you know, as a byproduct, or as a, you know, automatically by offering to Krishna and then taking. And then I'm getting my both objectives. My belly is full, my tongue is happy, and I'm making spiritual progress. So that's another practice. To associate with people who are interested, who are serious about spiritual advancement. Very powerful thing. If I want to make advancement in business, I associate with business people, and they'll give me all sorts of tips about, you know, what they've done that's worked, and maybe where the opportunities are, and whatever it is in business. I go to the stock exchange, and, you know, that's where the business is centered. I don't go to the sports arena. That's not the place for that. So if you associate with people who are serious about Bhakti Yoga, serious about spiritual advancement, then that practice also keeps moving in the same direction. So as you learn about Bhakti Yoga, you learn more and more things that you can do as regular practice in your life that molds your life in such a way that materially and spiritually you're moving forward. Materially, that's included in the package, and spiritually is your real purpose.
Okay. Yeah. Does the psychology of a person affect their ability to make spiritual progress?
Yeah.
Person's psychology affects his spiritual progress, sure. Let's look at psychology again, not in terms of Freud or Jung or any of those folks. Let's look at it in terms of the three modes of nature. The person who's in the motivators has one kind of psychology. The person who's in passion has a different kind of psychology, and the person who's in goodness has a different kind. And that affects you. If you're in ignorance, your spiritual progress is going to be dragged down. It's going to be very, very slow or nil. If you're in passion, you'll make some progress, but it's going to hold you back. Sorry, no time, I gotta go after you. Your life is distraction. Your life is thirst and satisfying your immediate desires. So that is ignorance, but it's not the greatest. But if your mind is in goodness, and you have a different kind of psychology, you're patient, you're tolerant, you're focused on what matters, you're humble, you're cultivating knowledge, That's a different kind of psychology. So the psychology or the mindset in goodness is more favorable. Passion less and ignorance is the pits.
What about male and female?
What about them? I mean, it's a big topic, but do you want to know?
Well, when you mentioned the three modes of, if I get feeling that you can change from ignorance to passion to goodness, but in terms of male and female psychology, can you change that psychology?
From a male psychology to a female psychology? Is that what you're asking? Can you change from one to
another?
Is one, the best one is the one you're in. To have a male psychology with a female body creates a lot of stress and confusion. And it's in one sense superficial. Because when you're coming to the mode of goodness, then you're knowing that I'm not this body. And what is male or female? It's this body. So we want to transcend that I'm man, I'm woman. We are, because I have this body, which is either one or the other. But that's not my real identity, that's not my real anything. So I want my consciousness to come to be connected with Krishna. And then, whether I'm a man, I'm connected with Krishna, or a woman, I'm connected with Krishna. It doesn't matter.
It's just connected to what she was asking about psychology. Just in terms of environment, as much as you might not want to be conditioned by the surroundings, whether you come from a poor background or an alcoholic or abusive environment, how do you try and discover this idea of consciousness when your consciousness is determined by your environment a lot of the time? And yeah, how do you get to that basis where you're not judging yourself based on that and trying to kind of dissect yourself away from the idea of yourself within an environment and the idea of yourself as a person?
How do we separate ourselves from our environment, or how does our environment affect our spiritual progress? Really good question. First thing is that even the body can be considered part of the environment, because it's not who I am, it's what I'm in. So my body itself is part of the environment, and it's connected with the larger environment, my community, my home, my school, my country, my what have you. The first crucial step is to understand that I really don't have anything to do with my environment. I'm not this body. So whether it's tall or short, whether it's old or young, whether it's this or that, it really has nothing to do with me. You know, I'm thinking that I am Russian. And therefore, I write novels that reflect the struggles of the Russian people, and blah, 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 blah. And a person who's self-realized says, I'm not Russian. I'm not South African. I'm not American. I'm not white. I'm not black. I'm not old. I'm not young. I'm not this body. That's his first understanding. And therefore, the surrounding, because I'm not this body, this is not actually my home. This is not actually my school. This is not actually my anything. I am mine. That's a mistake. None of it is mine. I'm going through it for some time. But it's all connected with the body, and the body is not me. So the stuff that happens to the body, okay, I'm in this body, I'm connected with this body. At the moment we said we're a combination of body and soul. But the one is external, it's all part of the environment, and the other is myself. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Well, therefore, in one sense, you know, what my background is, I came from a poor family, or I came from an intellectual family, or I came from a rich family, or I came from a broken home, or I came from, you know, what have you. That's external to me. I may be from this environment, that environment. Good example, Narayana. He's one of the greatest sages. He was the son of a maidservant. His mother was a maidservant that's, you know, cleaning up and doing menial jobs. And he was just a, you know, a little boy. That's who he was. And in India, there's a rainy season, and that's 4 months, and it rains buckets. So the sages who usually travel around, during that season, they stay put. They choose one place, and they sit down, because that's all they can do. So they happen to come and stay in this one cottage. And this maidservant was assisting them, you know, doing what, washing dishes and doing whatever it was. And the boy was helping. And the sages were talking sage stuff. You know, they were talking about spiritual topics. That's how they would spend their time. And the boy was hearing. You know, he was there, so he was hearing what they were talking about. And by hearing, he became attracted. And by becoming attracted, he became more attracted. And he started developing, you know, that spiritual nature himself. And he took a little of the food that, you know, they would leave on their plates, and that kind of, like, spiritually contaminated him. You know, he picked up their spiritual nature. And he became a great sage. You know, from the humblest kind of background, he wasn't coming out of Wits or Harvard or something. And he became a great sage. And there are many such examples. It doesn't matter whether I'm coming from high family or low family, or rich or poor, or messed up or stable. The spiritual nature is so powerful that it transcends all of these material environments.
How do you fully accept your identity as a soul without haphazardly giving up material existence in the guise of being detached? You mentioned determination in the mode of goodness. So how do you still fulfill your duty, but at the same time fully identify yourself as the soul?
Knowledge is where you can do that. When you're in knowledge, you know, well, I'm not this body, but I have this body, and so I have to maintain the body properly, and here's how I do it, and I don't overdo it and think that this is what my life is all about, just the body. So when you're in goodness, or when you're in knowledge, you're in the best position to do that. When you're in ignorance, you're the worst. You don't even know how to maintain your body. You see these guys on, you know, in America, New York, it would be Skid Row, it would be the Bowery. And, you know, they don't know whether their clothes are on or off. They don't know whether they're bandaged or not bandaged. They don't know whether they're on the moon or in New York City. So they can't even maintain their material existence. In passion, it's all about maintaining my material existence. And so they lose sight of their spiritual nature. So they're doing all this stuff for their material advancement, but they don't know who they are. They think they're working for their self-interest, and they don't know who the self is. So they're confused. And the person in the mode of goodness has clarity. He sees, yeah, I'm not this body, but the body needs, you know, I have to put petrol in the car. I don't have to spend my life for the car, but I have to make sure the engine runs. I have to see that the windshield, the windscreen is clear. So I maintain this body as much as needed. And I think about where I'm going. And I put everything together in a proper way so that these objectives are achieved. I get some guidance from spiritually enlightened teacher who can help me, give me instruction, how to do it. I take up the practices of bhakti yoga that will help me go in that direction. It's not contradictory. I can't, my body has to fall apart because I'm interested in spiritual life. It's not that. But everything, everything about my material side of my life just has to go to hell because I don't care. That's kind of passion, really. That's called renunciation of passion. Chuck it all. I'm spiritual. Thoughtfully, what am I doing? And I get knowledge from books of knowledge, from qualified teachers. I understand what is why. I'm not just like, having jumped off one side of the ship, I don't get back on the ship and jump off the other side. That's not the idea. Balance. And Bhagavad Gita Krishna talks about balance. Yes.
I'm not sure how to pose this question exactly. I heard you say for spiritual fulfillment, it's pretty much bhakti yoga. I want to know, how does that go along with religion? Because there's so many religions, and do you have to somehow follow some religion to believe, follow some other religion to believe in that higher power, or just practice? I'm kind of confused.
You have this religion or that religion, that's okay. Bhakti yoga, and anyone can practice whatever. It's not for particular people of a particular religion. Yoga means connection with God. And bhakti means by service with devotion. So a Christian can do that. He can connect with God by service through devotion. A Hindu can do that. A Muslim can do that. Anyone can do that. That's the thing. And there are some techniques, some practices, which whatever religion you belong to will help you in achieve that objective. Is that okay?
If my original nature is one that is transcendental to material, why am I even attracted to material things, and why am I even
attracted? Why am I, good question, my nature is spiritual originally, why am I attracted? By looking in the wrong direction, basically. Our nature is to look toward Krishna and be connected with Krishna and serve Krishna. But we have tiny independence, and when we misuse it, we look away from Krishna and say, what about me? I don't want to do all that. I want to, what about my enjoyment? Then immediately we're in material nature. And then we get bounced around between these modes, ignorance, passion, goodness, and then it becomes a big trap, big net. Okay.
Does anyone else have any questions?
Maharaj, you spoke about the benefit that Narada would have gained by assisting those sages and maybe hearing. Could you maybe elaborate how that really impacts in the change of consciousness?
Hearing is so important. Just by hearing, one gets direction. Suddenly there were a fire and the room filled up with smoke and everybody's panicking and you heard, over here! You know, that's your way out. You can't see because of the smoke. You're confused, you don't know which way to go. But you hear that sound. The door is over here. And that's all you need that sound. Sound is very powerful. So this Hare Krishna sound, or sound of Vedic knowledge, is coming from the spiritual platform. It's powerful. It's spiritually purifying. It gives us spiritual direction. How do you get knowledge? By sound. You come to the university. How do you learn what you learn? It's mostly by sound, isn't it? You sit and the professor says, blah, 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 blah. And if you're listening carefully, then you know you're set. You know, blah, 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 blah. By sound. You get knowledge by sound. And spiritual knowledge is not just kind of book knowledge, but it enters the heart, it becomes realization.
So on behalf of the Bhakti Yoga Society, we'd like to thank His Holiness J. Vedaswami for visiting us today, and we have a little token of our appreciation for him.
Thank you, sir.
Let us express our gratitude. So we